Welcome to the Northwest Missouri State University Sexual Misconduct Prevention Training, keeping our campus and community safe for all students. The purpose of this training is to keep our campus a safe place where all students can be educated without the threat or fear of sexual misconduct. This training will provide you with information about identifying sexual misconduct, policies the university has implemented to prevent it, and things that you and your friends can do to keep each other safe. In addition, this training will provide you with resources about sexual misconduct and services the university can provide. Additional information is available at the website indicated at the bottom of this slide. University policy defines sexual misconduct as unwelcome sexual conduct that includes sexual harassment, sexual violence, and retaliation against those who make complaints of sexual harassment or sexual violence, as well as those who participate in the university's investigation process, such as witnesses. The university's non-discrimination and anti-harassment policy prohibits all sexual misconduct. A full copy of the policy is available on the university's website at the address indicated here. You can also obtain a physical copy of the university's policy from the Title IX coordinator, who will be identified later in this training. The university expects all students to read, know, and follow the non-discrimination and anti-harassment policy. You should know that sexual misconduct is also prohibited by federal law, including Title IX of the Higher Education Act. Violating the university's prohibition on sexual misconduct is a very serious thing that can result in a range of discipline, up to and including expulsion. University policy defines sexual misconduct to include sexual harassment, sexual advances, requests for sexual favors, and other verbal, physical, or visual conduct constitutes sexual harassment when the conduct is unwelcome and it substantially interferes with the victim's academic or professional performance or creates what a reasonable person would perceive as an intimidating, hostile, or offensive environment, or where submission to the conduct is made a term or condition of the victim's education or employment. You may ask, how do I know whether conduct is unwelcome? The university determines whether sexual conduct is unwelcome depending on all the facts and circumstances. But here are some useful guidelines. If a person has affirmatively indicated that the conduct is offensive, unwanted, or makes them uncomfortable, then it is unwelcome. If a person has been on the receiving end of the conduct before and has not responded and avoided further interaction, continued conduct is likely unwelcome. Some sexual conduct is so blatant as to be inherently unwelcome, such as groping a stranger in public or mass emailing pornography to people you haven't met before. If a person does not solicit, initiate, or invite the conduct, that may be a sign it is unwelcome. To determine whether conduct is harassing, you may ask yourself the following questions. Would I mind if someone treated my spouse or partner, mother or father, sibling or boyfriend or girlfriend this way? Would I mind if someone told my spouse or partner, mother or father, sibling or boyfriend or girlfriend about what I was saying or doing? Ask yourself, would I engage in this conduct if my spouse or partner, mother or father, sibling, or boyfriend or girlfriend were present? Would I mind if a news reporter wanted to write about what I'm doing? Am I engaging in the conduct because someone told me to stop and I'm angry? If the answer to any one of these questions is yes, there is a considerable risk that your conduct is harassing. Some examples of sexual harassment include repeated, unwelcome pressure for a romantic or dating relationship, unwelcome sexual touching, kissing, or groping, telling sexual jokes to someone who doesn't want to hear them, exposing yourself to another without permission, pressuring a person to have sex when they've told you they don't want to, texting sexually explicit pictures or messages to those who don't want to see them, telling lies about a person's sex life to others, and making unwanted sexual gestures. Let's consider the following example. Sean has a crush on Jenny. He's asked her out multiple times, and she's turned him down. He comments on one of her Facebook photos that she's sexy. Later, he comes up to Jenny in the cafeteria, and she tells him to leave her alone because she's not interested. Sean thinks he'll send Jenny some roses and chocolates to make up for upsetting her and bring them by her apartment later that night. Sean should stop. Jenny isn't interested in him, and further advances on her are harassment because they constitute repeated, unwelcome pressure for a romantic relationship. He should leave her alone. Let's consider a second example. Ty goes to meet with a graduate teaching assistant, James, during office hours. James is only a few years older than Ty and finds Ty attractive. James compliments Ty on his classwork and indicates to Ty he just might get an A if you spend more time with me outside of class. How about we go to St. Joe tomorrow night? This is sexual harassment. James is trying to leverage Ty's grade for a romantic relationship. It does not matter that Ty and James are both men. Sexual harassment can occur between persons of the same sex as well as persons of the opposite sex. As noted before, unwelcome sexual conduct rises to the level of sexual harassment if it creates a hostile environment for the victim. But how does the university determine whether unwelcome conduct creates a hostile environment? The university will review the totality of the circumstances to determine whether a reasonable person in the victim's position would feel there is a hostile environment. Some factors that will be considered include the severity of the conduct, whether the conduct was isolated or repeated, the age of the victim, whether the alleged perpetrator held a position of power or authority over the victim, and the effect the conduct has on the victim's daily life and activities. In addition to prohibiting sexual harassment, the university's prohibition on sexual misconduct extends to sexual violence. The university defines sexual violence to include physical sexual acts perpetrated against a person's will, or when the person is not capable of giving consent due to a mental or physical incapacity, drug or alcohol intoxication, or because of the person's youth, meaning they are below the age of legal consent in the state where the physical sexual act occurs. Sexual violence includes sexual intercourse of any kind without valid consent, unwilling sexual penetration with an object or body part, groping a person's genitals without their consent, prostituting a person, knowingly transmitting a sexually transmitted disease, and secretly recording sexual activity without permission. As noted prior, physical sexual acts constitute sexual violence when they are perpetrated without valid consent. But what is valid consent? Four factors are important. Valid consent must be informed, freely given, mutually understood, and most importantly, requires an affirmative act or statement that a reasonable person would perceive as consent. The safest course in any situation is to obtain from both parties an affirmative verbal statement of permission, such as, "Do you want to have sex?" with the answer being yes, or "How far do you want to go?" and the answer being, "You can touch me, but I don't want to have sex," in which case The explicit consent only extends to touching, but not actual intercourse. It is also useful to think about what is not valid consent. If coercion, threats, intimidation, or force are used to obtain consent, that consent is not valid. If a person is incapacitated due to a disability or drug or alcohol use, he or she is not capable of giving effective consent. If a person is asleep or unconscious, he or she cannot give consent. And remember, consent to one form of sexual activity does not constitute consent to all forms of sexual activity. And the fact that you are dating does not, in and of itself, constitute implied consent to engage in sexual activity. Here are some useful tips in considering whether a person is too drunk or high to give effective consent. When the person is passed out, the person is stumbling, staggering, or cannot walk without help. The person can't remember other people's names. The person doesn't know where they are or have to be reminded where they are. The person is throwing up. The person has to be reminded of what they are doing. The person has to lie down. The person is doing and saying things they would otherwise never do. The person appears dazed or confused. Or the person's fine motor skills are inhibited such that he or she cannot, for example, hold a drink, a fork, a pencil, or some other object without dropping it. Remember, consent requires an affirmative act or statement. The university will not recognize consent by mere silence. Sexual conduct, including physical sexual acts, will be deemed unwelcome unless there is an affirmative act or statement of consent. This means that a victim is not required to affirmatively or physically resist or say stop in order for there to be sexual harassment or sexual violence. Let's consider the following example. Jack and Kate have been dating for some time. Kate has previously told Jack she is a virgin and doesn't want to have sex until she's married. One night the two are making out, and Jack gets on top of Kate and begins to unbutton her pants. Kate is taken aback and too afraid to say anything. Jack proceeds to have sex with Kate, who lays silently on the bed and simply closes her eyes. In this situation, Jack did not have consent because Kate did not, by way of affirmative act or statement, consent to having sex. Kate's agreeing to make out does not mean she consented to sex, and she was not required to affirmatively resist Jack. Again, there is no such thing as consent by mere silence. Let's consider another example. Jill and Jane meet at a bar and have several drinks. They walk back to Jill's apartment. Although Jill is walking fine, Jane is slurring her words and having trouble standing up. She even forgets Jill's name. She tells Jill she wants to fool around. Jill should stop. Jane is too drunk in this situation to give valid consent. If Jill has sexual contact with Jane, she will violate the university's non-discrimination and anti-harassment policy. It does not matter that Jill and Jane are members of the same sex. The university's prohibition on sexual violence extends to all persons and prohibits sexual violence between members of the same sex as well as members of the opposite sex. Let's consider a final example. Jack and Danny have been a couple for 2 months. They have had consensual sex before. They are making out on Danny's bed when Jack says that he is tired and wants to stop. But Danny wants to continue and pins Jack down while he pulls down his pants. Danny should stop. Jack may have given consent to make out, but he has not given consent for sex, and he's affirmatively said he wants to stop. The fact that Jack and Danny had consensual sex in the past is not relevant. While being drunk may make it impossible for a victim to give valid consent, being drunk is never an excuse to engage in sexual violence. It is not an excuse for a perpetrator to claim that he or she was too drunk to recognize the victim was incapable of giving effective consent. In other words, being drunk is never an excuse to commit sexual violence. Under the university's policy, anyone who chooses to drink or use drugs and then commits sexual violence will still be held accountable for their actions. You may have seen or heard of others who like to get people drunk or high in order to make it easier to have sex with them. This is never okay and violates the university's policy. Giving someone drugs such as Rohypnol, tranquilizers, or opiates so they can have sex with you is never okay. The use of alcohol or incapacitating drugs is common in cases of date rape. So if you see someone put something in your drink, or you think someone is trying to get you drunk to take advantage of you, or if you feel ill or woozy like you have been drugged, you should leave the situation immediately and seek help from your friends or others. Sexual violence can occur between people in an existing relationship, including people who are married or dating. University policy prohibits sexual violence and other forms of physical violence between persons who live together and people who are dating. These types of violence are called domestic assault and dating violence. University policy also prohibits stalking, including stalking that is sexual in nature. Under the university's policy, domestic assault consists of violence or attempted violence perpetrated against a family or household member. Family or household member is defined broadly to include spouses, former spouses, any person related by blood or marriage, persons presently residing together or who have resided together in the past, any person who is or has been in a continuing social relationship of a romantic or intimate nature with the victim, and anyone who has a child in common, regardless of whether they have been married or resided together in the past. Under university policy, dating violence consists of violence committed by a person who is or has been in a social relationship of a romantic nature with the victim. A relationship is romantic in nature if it is characterized by the expectation of affection or sexual involvement. In determining whether a romantic relationship exists, the university will consider the length of the relationship, the type of the relationship, and the frequency of the interaction of the parties to that relationship. A person commits stalking if he or she purposefully, through a course of conduct, harasses or follows another with the intent of harassing him or her. A course of conduct means a pattern involving two or more acts, which may include communication by any means over a period of time, no matter how short. But conduct that is protected by the First Amendment, such as arguing over policy or politics with a fellow student in class, is not stalking. Domestic assault, dating violence, and stalking typically occur in the context of relationships that are characterized by emotional and/or physical abuse. There are several important warning signs of such abusive relationships. They include: you are afraid of your partner much of the time. Your partner has an explosive temper that results in violence. Your partner injures you or has threatened to injure you. Your partner sees you as a sex object rather than as a person. Your partner gives you injuries that you are hiding from others. Your partner checks your phone or email without permission to see what you are doing and who you are communicating with. Your partner restricts who you can talk to or where you can go. Your partner gets angry if you won't have sex with him. Your partner calls you demeaning names in a mean-spirited way. If you are the victim of domestic assault, dating violence, or stalking, a court may be able to enter a protection order or restraining order to protect you. While the university cannot represent you in court, the Title IX coordinator can give you the names of local attorneys who specialize in domestic violence cases. If you obtain a protection or restraining order, please give a copy to the Title IX coordinator so the university can assist in enforcing the order on campus. The university always reserves the right to issue its own no-contact order, regardless of what a court may do. As members of the Northwest community, we all have an obligation to stop sexual violence. Sexual violence, domestic violence, dating violence, and stalking are against university policy, are harmful to victims, and illegal. We have an ethical duty to step in and stop violence that is about to occur or is occurring. So if you are a bystander and see that someone is about to be victimized, please intervene and get help. And if you are a bystander and see that one of your friends is about to commit violence, please stop them. They'll thank you for it in the long run. Here are some tips that you can use as a bystander. If you suspect that someone is in trouble, you should err on the side of intervening. Your goal should be to get the victim to a place of safety, to remove them from the threatening situation. If you are uncomfortable intervening, get one or more friends to help, and then intervene together. If the situation is an emergency, you can call 911 or campus police, even though you aren't the victim. And remember, you have the right to make a report of misconduct to the university, even if you aren't the victim. If you do learn about sexual misconduct after it happens, you can offer to assist the victim in making a report. You can even go with them to an appropriate university official. We should all work to keep our friends out of trouble. Don't help or facilitate your friends if they are engaging in sexual misconduct. Your assistance could constitute a violation of the university's policy. Remind your friends that sexual misconduct is prohibited and that there will be serious consequences. If your friend is drunk or high and engaging in misconduct, try to redirect them and get them away from the situation safely. And if you have a friend that is known for engaging in misconduct, consider confronting him or her with others if you can do so safely. In addition to prohibiting sexual harassment and sexual violence, the university's sexual misconduct policy prohibits retaliation. As you will learn, the university encourages you to report sexual misconduct that you experience or observe. When such a report is made, the university conducts an investigation and takes appropriate action if the report is substantiated by a preponderance of the evidence. People who make reports or who participate in the investigation, such as witnesses, are protected from retaliation committed by the alleged perpetrator or by the alleged perpetrator's friends. Retaliation is a violation of the non-discrimination and anti-harassment policy. Let's consider the following example. Kate makes a report to the Dean of Students that Travis, her ex-boyfriend, has texted nude photos of Kate to his friends in retaliation for her breaking up with him. Travis learns of the report and tells Kate if she doesn't drop her complaint, he'll circulate a video he secretly made of the two having sex. Travis is committing retaliation. He is threatening to take adverse action against Kate because she made a report. This is a violation of university policy and will subject Travis to severe discipline, up to and including expulsion. Remember, the university's prohibition on sexual misconduct extends to all members of the university community, regardless of their sexual orientation or gender. This means that sexual harassment, sexual violence, and retaliation are prohibited even if they occur between people of the same sex or gender. And this means that both men and women are protected from sexual misconduct. If you experience sexual misconduct or observe it, the university strongly encourages you to make a report. Students who wish to report sexual misconduct can do so by filing a report with the university's Title IX coordinator or with the university's deputy Title IX coordinator. In addition, all university employees, other than certain confidential reporters, are required to refer reports of sexual misconduct to the Title IX coordinator. This means that you, as a student, can also make a report to another university administrator, a trusted faculty member, a resident assistant, or even a coach or assistant coach if you are an athlete. If you believe that you may be the victim of sexual misconduct but you aren't sure, please make a report. University officials will help you determine whether your report implicates potential sexual misconduct and should be investigated. You are not required to determine whether or not you have suffered a hostile environment before you decide to make a report of unwelcome sexual conduct. This slide contains the contact information for the university's Title IX coordinator and deputy student coordinator. This information is also available on the university's website. You can contact the Title IX coordinator or the deputy student coordinator by phone, in person, or by email. If you make a report to the Title IX coordinator or deputy student coordinator, you should expect the following. They will explain to you your rights under the university's policies and procedures. They will discuss your option to make a criminal report to law enforcement. They will notify you of resources for victim advocacy, counseling, medical and mental health services, and local options for legal assistance. They will discuss with you interim remedial measures to protect you before, during, and after the investigation, such as changes in class or living arrangements or other accommodations. And they will take down information about your report so an investigation can be undertaken. Reports made to the Title IX coordinator or deputy student coordinator are not confidential. However, if you wish to make a confidential report of sexual misconduct, that is, you do not want the university to know anything about the incident, you may make a report to a confidential reporter. The confidential reporters are the counselors at the university's Personal Development and Counseling Services and the doctors and nurses at University Wellness Services. If you make a report to a support staff member of a confidential reporter, such as a secretary or scheduler, university officials will not be told your name, but certain non-identifying information may be provided for statistical purposes. Although reports made to the Title IX coordinator and deputy student coordinator are not confidential, the university will be discreet in handling your report and will not disclose information except to the extent necessary to complete a full and complete investigation. But confidentiality cannot be guaranteed unless you make a report to a confidential reporter. Unless your report is made to a confidential reporter, the university does reserve the right to move forward with an investigation, even if you subsequently request confidentiality, in the event that there is a continuing threat to you or other members of the campus community. This slide contains the contact information for confidential reporters. Again, the confidential reporters are the counselors at Personal Development and Counseling Services and the healthcare professionals at University Wellness Services. Contact information for specific counselors and specific medical professionals is available on the university's website at the links indicated here. There are other reporting options as well. If you are the victim of sexual violence, domestic violence, dating violence, or stalking, and need support, but do not wish to make any report to the university or police, you can contact a local or national victim assistance group. These third-party groups, which are not affiliated with the university, will not notify the university about your report without your permission. Information on certain third-party groups is available on the university's website at the link indicated here. You may wonder at what time it is appropriate to make a report of sexual misconduct. Students can make a report of sexual misconduct at any time, even if the sexual misconduct occurred in the past. But do understand, delayed reporting can make it more difficult for the university to investigate the report and take appropriate action. Therefore, the university strongly encourages you to make reports of sexual misconduct as soon as possible and within 60 days of the misconduct occurring. The university's investigation of sexual misconduct is separate from any law enforcement investigation. So if you are the victim of sexual violence, in addition to filing a report with the university, you also have the right to file a report with the university police or local law enforcement. And the university encourages you to do so. Whether or not you contact local law enforcement is up to you, unless there is an emergency affecting the safety of others, in which case the university may contact law enforcement. If you wish to make a report to law enforcement, the university will help you in doing so. And remember, regardless of whether you choose to notify police, if you make a non-confidential report, the university will take appropriate action. If you find yourself in an emergency situation involving sexual violence and fear for your safety, you should immediately dial 911. If you do not have an immediate fear for your safety, the university recommends that you promptly seek medical attention at a local hospital where you may or may not choose to undergo a sexual assault examination. At the hospital, staff will advise you of the option to contact law enforcement, and the university recommends that you do so. After you have received emergency care, the university encourages you to make a report of sexual misconduct to the university itself. It is important for victims of sexual violence to understand that they may have evidence on their clothes or person that will assist in identifying the perpetrator and obtaining a restraining order. Accordingly, if you are the victim of sexual violence, you should not bathe, urinate, douche, brush your teeth, drink liquids, or change your clothes until after you are examined by a medical professional or law enforcement officer. You should also try to preserve other evidence, such as letters, emails, and text messages. Victims of sexual violence often experience the effects of trauma and shock that may include feelings of fear, powerlessness, guilt, shame, embarrassment, anger, betrayal, and denial. It is important not to blame yourself. No one deserves to be the victim of sexual violence. The university has counseling services, free of charge for students, available to help you and can also put you in contact with third-party victim advocates and other professionals. The university can also help you to contact your family or a trusted friend or advisor. The university's Lighthouse Project and the Northwest Coalition Against Violence partner to provide education, intervention, and advocacy to victims of sexual violence and to educate members of our community about sexual violence. Additional information about sexual violence, including more information on what to do if you are a victim, how to make a report, and how to help sexual violence victims, is available at the following web address. Oftentimes, victims of sexual violence who were drinking or using drugs at the time are fearful that they will be punished if they report sexual violence. Please be assured, the university's primary concern is the physical safety of its students and the prevention of sexual violence. The use of alcohol or drugs by the victim never makes sexual violence the victim's fault. The university's practice is not to prosecute or report a victim's drinking or personal drug use, even when such use is disclosed in the context of a sexual misconduct report. When the university receives a non-confidential report of sexual misconduct, the university will implement its complaint resolution procedures. These procedures are available on the university's website at the following web address. They are also available in hard copy from the Title IX coordinator and the deputy student coordinator. The complaint resolution procedures are the exclusive means by which the university will resolve reports of sexual misconduct. They are administered by university officials who have received training on sexual misconduct and a hearing and investigation process that protects the parties and promotes accountability. There are five parts to the complaint resolution procedures. First, the university will impose necessary interim remedial measures to separate the parties during the investigation and to protect the alleged victim. Second, the university will conduct a prompt, fair, and impartial investigation of the report. Third, at the conclusion of the investigation, the university will issue a determination as to whether or not a violation of university policy occurred, and that determination will be based on a preponderance of the evidence standard, meaning more likely than not. Fourth, the university will issue discipline to the perpetrator if there was a finding of a violation, and if necessary, will issue further remedial measures for the victim and the wider campus community. Fifth and finally, both parties have the right to appeal. In determining whether interim remedial measures are necessary, the investigator working with the university's Title IX coordinator will meet with the parties to a complaint and consider what actions should be taken to separate and protect the parties before, during, and after the investigation. The imposition of interim remedies is not a final adjudication of guilt, but rather is a temporary measure to protect the parties. Potential interim measures include placing limitations on the ability of the parties to contact each other, a so-called no-contact order, making alternative academic or workplace arrangements, making alternative housing arrangements, providing counseling services to the alleged victim and/or the alleged perpetrator, and in cases where there is probable cause to believe the alleged perpetrator is a continuing threat, interim remedial measures may include suspension or limitations on the alleged perpetrator's presence on campus. Finally, interim measures may include direction that the parties not disclose the report and investigation to uninvolved third parties. Under university policy, it is very important that all parties to a complaint of sexual misconduct abide by interim measures. Intentionally violating interim measures is a separate violation of university policy. It also violates university policy to indirectly violate interim measures, such as by having a friend contact the alleged victim when a no-contact order has been put in place. The next step in the complaint resolution procedures is the investigation. During the investigation, an investigator will meet with both the alleged victim and the alleged perpetrator. The parties will have the right to identify witnesses and other evidence for consideration. The investigator may interview other persons with relevant knowledge and review other evidence that is independently identified. If the investigator determines that there are genuinely disputed facts about what happened, then a hearing panel will be convened to hold an evidentiary hearing and determine what happened under a preponderance of the evidence standard. What is a preponderance? A preponderance means something is more likely true than not true. Something greater than 50% is a preponderance. The university uses a preponderance of the evidence standard because it is required by the U.S. Department of Education's interpretation of Title IX of the Higher Education Act. The university's investigation is not a criminal prosecution. Therefore, the proof beyond a reasonable doubt standard that applies in criminal prosecutions does not apply to the university's internal investigation and determination of sexual misconduct reports. The university understands that a sexual misconduct investigation and hearing can be an intimidating process. Therefore, during the investigation and hearing, both parties have the right to be accompanied by a support person of their choice. The purpose of the support person is to provide personal support to the party, but the support person does not serve as an advocate and cannot be actively involved in the proceedings. If you want a support person but are unable to identify one, the investigator can refer you to one or more university employees who have agreed to serve in this role. The third stage in the complaint resolution procedures is the issuance of a determination. After the investigation and any hearing are complete, the Title IX coordinator will issue a written report that explains whether a violation of university policy occurred. Even if the report finds that sexual misconduct did not occur, the report may identify violations of other university policies. The written report will include a statement of any discipline imposed, as well as a statement of reasonable and appropriate measures the university will take to remedy the effects of any sexual misconduct that has occurred. The written report is jointly issued to both parties. As explained at the introduction of this presentation, sexual misconduct, including domestic violence, dating violence, and stalking, is a serious violation of university policy. Persons who are found to have committed sexual misconduct should expect that they will be subject to the full range of sanctions and discipline, which includes required sexual harassment training, reprimand, probation, restrictions on presence on campus, suspension or exclusion from university activities, sports, housing, and other extracurricular functions, full suspension for any length of time, denial of degree, and expulsion. If the university determines that you are the victim of sexual misconduct, the university has a range of remedial and protective measures that it may offer in the determination. They include counseling, physical and mental health treatment, modifications to living arrangements, modifications to class schedules and progress towards degree, the issuance of permanent no-contact orders, the enforcement of court-ordered restraining orders or similar orders, and providing an escort to walk you to class or to your dorm. After a determination is issued, either party has the right to appeal the outcome if he or she believes the decision was contrary to the substantial weight of the evidence. There is a substantial likelihood that newly discovered information, not previously available, would result in a different outcome. The investigator or Title IX coordinator was biased or prejudiced, or the punishment or corrective action is disproportionate to the offense. A party wishing to file an appeal must do so within 10 days of receipt of the written determination. Appeals are to be filed with the provost and must include certain information specified in the complaint resolution procedures. The provost will resolve the appeal within 15 days of receiving it and will take all actions that he or she determines to be in the interest of a fair and just decision. The decision of the provost is final and not subject to further appeal. In most cases, the university will complete its investigation and determination within 60 days of a report being made. The university may temporarily delay its investigation to avoid interfering with an ongoing law enforcement investigation, but the university will complete its investigation and determination regardless of the outcome of the law enforcement investigation. If the investigation and determination will be delayed beyond 60 days, The parties will be so notified by the university. Your best resource for information on sexual misconduct and pertinent university policies is the university's Title IX website, which is at the address indicated here. This website contains the non-discrimination and anti-harassment policy, the complaint resolution procedures, contact information for the Title IX coordinator and deputy student coordinator, various additional resources for victims of sexual misconduct, as well as a set of frequently asked questions that address additional points and topics not covered in today's training. This slide contains several important phone numbers for individuals referenced in today's training, including the Title IX coordinator and deputy student coordinator, to whom reports of sexual misconduct may be made. The Title IX coordinator and deputy student coordinator are also available to answer your questions about the university's prohibition on sexual misconduct and the process by which the university investigates reports. Phone numbers are also indicated for the counselors at Personal Development and Counseling Services and the medical professionals at University Wellness Services. Remember, these individuals are confidential reporters, so if you wish to make a report of sexual misconduct but do not want the university to know your name or identifying information, you must make a report to one of these specified confidential reporters. Finally, contact information for the university police is provided. Remember, if you are in an emergency, your best course is to call 911. This slide contains phone numbers for important third-party resources, including the Children and Family Center of Northwest Missouri, which has a 24-hour crisis hotline for victims of sexual misconduct, the National Sexual Assault Hotline, as well as the National Domestic Violence Hotline. These entities are not affiliated with the university, and they will not forward reports of sexual misconduct to the university without your permission. In a few moments, you will take a 15-minute quiz that covers the topics in today's training. Please take this quiz seriously. Although your answers are not graded, the quiz provides important illustrations and will help you further understand the university's policies and resources that are available to you. Completion of the quiz is mandatory for all students receiving this sexual misconduct training. Thank you for completing this sexual misconduct training. In conclusion, please remember, the university does not tolerate sexual misconduct of any kind. The university will investigate reports of sexual misconduct and take appropriate action. You are encouraged to report suspected sexual misconduct of which you are the victim or which you observe. We all share responsibility for keeping our campus and community safe, and the university has resources available to help victims of sexual misconduct and to educate our campus community.